Very interesting and dark matter.
Okay, thank you very much for inviting me to give the seminar. So the title I gave Lee was Particle Physics from a Warped Extra Dimension. So I've changed it only slightly, but the content is the same. So basically I'm going to talk about particle physics, so issues of flavor, grand unification, and dark matter in the framework of a warped extra dimension. And in particular, I'll show you that all these issues are interconnected, and the study of these issues actually will show you that this setup, or this framework, is as compelling as supersymmetry. Okay. So the first part is work done with Gilad Perez and Amarjeet Soni. Second part is work done with Roberto Contino and Raman Sutram. And the last part is work done with Geraldine and so on. Okay, so I think most of you know that there is a hierarchy of something like 15 orders of magnitude between the Planck scale and the electroweak scale. And in the standard model of particle physics, this hierarchy is it is unstable, or it's unnatural, once you include quantum correction. Okay? So namely that quantum corrections in the standard model tend to sort of drag the electroweak scale, or the Higgs mass, all the way up to the Planck scale. Okay, and usually this is called the hierarchy problem of the standard model. And for the last 10 or 15 years, sort of the most popular solution to stabilize this hierarchy between the Planck scale and the electroweak scale has been this idea known as supersymmetry, or SUSY. And very briefly, the idea is that you add a super partner for every particle in the standard model. And if you do that, what happens is that the quantum corrections to the Higgs mass actually cancel between the standard model particles and their super particles. Okay, and that's how the hierarchy between the Planck and the weak scale is stabilized, okay, in supersymmetric model. And the reason this has been the most popular solution is that the gauge coupling unification, this idea works very well in supersymmetric models. So here's a figure you might have seen many times. So what I'm plotting is the running or the evolution of the standard model gauge couplings as a function of energy. Okay? So here are the three couplings. So for example, here's what happens in the standard model. So as you evolve the three couplings, they sort of approach each other, but you see that they don't quite meet. Okay? So whereas when you go to the supersymmetric standard model, that is, you add the super partners for all the particles in the standard model, and then recalculate the running, or the evolution, then you can show that the three couplings meet quite precisely at something like 10 to the 16 GeV. Okay? And later on in the talk, I will be more quantitative about this level of unification.
What's that energy scale where all the lines kinked over on the left side?
Sorry, where? Here?
The lines all start off in the same direction as the standard model. And
oh, here, yeah. So that's because the super partners are somewhere here, just about at the TeV scale.
It's a super symmetry breaking scale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, so the couplings initially start running as in the standard model, but right at 1 TeV, there is that modification.
Just a question, if supposing the supersymmetry breaking scale is not at the Higgs scale, does that mean they won't meet?
Yeah, so what will happen is the kink will be at higher scales, that's what you're saying.
And then they won't
meet. But of course, there is a motivation to have the super partners at the TeV scale, because that's only the case where they solve the hierarchy problem. Okay? So the nice thing is that hierarchy problems motivate super partners, at the weak scale, and that leads to a prediction of gauge coupling unification.
The amount of kinks and the field content, right? If you move the kinks to the right, adjust the field content to make it still meet?
Yeah, you could. So that's why this is the minimal supersymmetric standard model. Okay, and so I'll assume the particle content of the minimal supersymmetric standard model. Okay. And so the nice thing is that the simplest model works. Okay. So with no additional particles, and with all the super partners at the weak scale, where they should be if you want to solve the hierarchy model. And then you can play more games like adding more particles and or changing the their masses and so on. But the nice thing is that the simplest model really works. Okay. All right, so then, of course, there are other nice features of supersymmetry. So for example, usually we impose a discrete symmetry called R parity to make the proton stable, and that actually results in a very good dark matter candidate. And it turns out that the corrections in supersymmetry to the precision tests done on the gauge bosons are also very small, because they actually occur at the loop level, so they're suppressed by loop factors, and also by the small strength of the coupling. Okay, of course, the minimal supersymmetric standard model, or the MSSM, has some problems. And one is that the present limit on the mass of the Higgs boson from the LEP2 experiment tells us that most of these models are fine-tuned at the level of something like a few percent. Okay, and the flavor, or the quark lepton sector, in the MSSM also does not look so good. So for example, the hierarchy of the quark and lepton masses has to be put in by hand, okay? Just like in the standard model. And I'm going to call this aspect the flavor puzzle of the standard model, or the MSSM. Okay, but what is worse is that if you put in generic masses for the superpartner, so generic supersymmetry breaking, then you tend to get flavor conversions, such as a kaon going into anti-kaon, which are too large. Okay? So this is actually ruled out by the data. Okay? So I call this the flavor problem of the MSSM, and this is a problem in many extensions of the standard model. Okay? That is, you tend to get too large, what are called flavor-changing neutral currents, or FCNC. Okay, the main point is that in the MSSM, there is sort of there are no built-in mechanisms to address either of these two issues. Okay, so of course today I want to talk about an alternative to supersymmetry, or a non-supersymmetric solution to the hierarchy problem. And this is based on the idea of framework of Watt experimentation, or Randall-Sundrum model. And I will show you that this framework actually has most of the nice features of supersymmetry without having most of its problems. So I'll begin with a brief introduction to this Randall-Sundrum model. In particular, I want to look at the model where the standard model gauge and fermion fields actually propagate in the extra dimension. Okay, so I'll call this standard model in the box. Okay, so then in the first part of the talk, I will show you that profiles or wave functions for the standard model fermions in the extra dimension actually solve the flavor puzzle of the standard model. Okay. Moreover, the same profiles have what is called a Gym mechanism in them, okay, at least for the first and second generation, because of which this framework, unlike supersymmetry, does not have a flavor problem. Okay, and very much like in the standard model, because of the heaviness of the top mass, the couplings of the third generation, the left-handed bottom and the top, they actually violate this Gym mechanism. Okay, so they do lead to flavor conversion. And I'll show you that this, in fact, leads to very striking signals at the B factory experiment. Okay, in the second part of the talk, I will look at the same fermion profiles, but now in a grand unified theory. And I'll show, as a result, that you get gauge coupling unification, which is comparable to supersymmetry. Then in the last part, I will show you that requiring proton stability in these grand unified theories actually leads to a stable particle. Yeah, but similar to what happens in supersymmetry. And in particular, this stable particle can be an exotic right-handed neutrino, and it's a very good dark matter candidate. Okay, and finally, in the conclusions, I'll briefly mention signals for this model at the LHC.
You say that you solve the flavor puzzle. Do you mean the problem or the puzzle?
Actually, it solves the flavor puzzle without causing any flavor problem. So I'll be more precise about that.
Are you trading a choice for a choice?
No, I'm saying you can solve the flavor puzzle and without generating excessive flavor changing effects. That's what I mean.
Okay. Yeah,
so, yeah. Okay, so before I go on, I want to point out something very interesting about this framework of the Watt extra dimension. And that's as follows. So here are some of the class of solutions to this Planck weak hierarchy problem. There are ideas in four dimensions. So here's the supersymmetry with a weakly coupled Higgs boson. There's also the non-supersymmetric option, namely that some kind of strong dynamics is actually involved in electroweak symmetry breaking. Then there are ideas involving extra dimensions, for example, the Randall-Sundrum model, or the very large or ADD extra dimension. Okay? Now the problem with these class of solutions with strong dynamics in four dimensions is that it's very difficult to do any calculations, okay, because of the strong interaction. The only exception is when the dynamics is QCD-like. So these are ideas called, or models called Technicolor. And then you can use the QCD data to do calculations. But it turns out that most of these models, these Technicolor models, are actually ruled out by the electroweak precision data. Okay? So you might think that the picture actually looks like this. But I want to show you that the real picture is more like this. Namely, that if the strong dynamics in four dimensions is of a special kind, so it's approximately conformal in nature, in that case, there is actually a dual description, which is actually weakly coupled. And that dual description actually involves an extra dimension, which is warped, namely, it's the Randall-Sundrum class of models. So this duality is based on the famous correspondence in string theory between five-dimensional anti-De space and four-dimensional conformal field theory. Okay? So at first, you might be surprised that five-dimensional theory can describe the same physics as a four-dimensional theory with strong dynamics. Okay? However, when you look at this five-dimensional theory from an effective four-dimensional point of view, you see that this theory is actually appears as a tower of particles called Kaluza-Klein mode, or KK mode. Okay? And the idea is simply that a five-dimensional particle, if you look at it from the four-dimensional point of view, it's really like a particle in a one-dimensional compact box. Okay? And then you're not surprised that you get a tower of modes, okay? Each mode corresponding to quantized momentum, in this case, in the extra dimension. Okay? And of course, this four-dimensional theory with strong dynamics also has a tower of composites or bound state, or had one. So the basic idea is that the KK modes in this five-dimensional theory are dual to the hadrons of the four-dimensional theory with strong dynamics. Okay? So actually, let me just finish this thought. Okay? And of course, as I said, it's the five-dimensional theory which is weakly coupled, which is more well-defined. And so all the calculations or all the work is actually done in the five-dimensional picture. Okay? However, as I'll show you in a few examples, this four-dimensional picture with the strong dynamics is much more intuitive, okay, in many cases. And that's why I'll keep using also this four-dimensional picture. Okay? But the basic idea is that these RS class of models should really be thought of as sort of weakly coupled tools to do calculations in a purely 4D, strongly interacting Higgs sector model.
So maybe this answers what I was going to say, but what about quantum corrections? If I have gauge field theories in the log, five-dimensional log, I don't know how to do quantum corrections.
Because you mean the theory is non-uniform? Right. So I don't know if I have time to get into details, but it turns out that for many observables you're interested in, actually you're not sensitive to the cutoff of the five-dimensional theory. Okay? So most of the effects come from the low-line KK. Even loop corrections.
So you just assume there's effective field theories.
Yeah, I should have said that. Yeah. So I'm assuming it's an effective field theory with some cutoff. But then your worry is that anything I calculate, especially at the loop level, will be sensitive to the cutoff.
Well, I'm also worried that the problems that we're trying to solve arise because of quantum corrections. So it's too cheap to solve in a theory in which I just don't study quantum corrections.
So I'll show you that, for example, the quantum corrections to the Higgs map, they are actually finite. Okay. And they're not sensitive to the color. Okay, so let me just begin with a brief review of this Randall-Sundrum model. So by the way, I should have said right at the beginning that just stop me if you have any questions. Okay? I'll be more than willing to answer. Okay, so let me begin with a review of this Randall-Sundrum model. And because of this duality, so actually, let me begin with the four-dimensional picture, which is the idea of four-dimensional strongly interacting Higgs sector, or a four-dimensional composite Higgs model. Okay? Okay, so the idea is very simple. There's some new strong dynamics, and the Higgs is a composite, okay, made of this strong dynamics, sort of like a pion in real QCD. Okay, so that the Higgs mass is actually protected by compositeness, okay, and not by any supersymmetry. Okay, so again, compositeness at the TV scale. And then of course the graviton, which is just elementary, not part of the strong dynamics, and it is just coupled to the strong dynamics with the usual strength of 1 over M1. Okay, clearly in addition to the Higgs, there is a whole tower of bound states or hadrons. Okay, and as I said, the problem is that the constituents of these hadrons are strongly coupled, and that makes any calculations very difficult. Okay, and as I already said, luckily and very remarkably, there is actually a weakly coupled dual description which involves a warped extra dimension, and this follows from the correspondence between five-dimensional ADS spaces and four-dimensional CFTs from string theory. So all you need to know about this duality for this talk is as follows. So I already told you, so think of the KK modes coming from this five-dimensional theory as hadrons of the four-dimensional strongly interacting theory. And then you need to know the following two sets of rules. Okay? So sort of the rule number one is that any particle which is an elementary degree of freedom, not part of the strong dynamics in the four-dimensional picture, actually is dual to a particle localized at one end of this extra dimension. And this end is called the Planck or the UV grid. Okay? Again, here's the extra dimension. It's a compact extra dimension. You can think of the four dimensions as being along this direction. Okay? Again, a particle which is not part of the strong dynamics is actually dual to a particle localized on the Planck grid. Similarly, a particle which is composite of an infrared degree of freedom in the four-dimensional picture corresponds to a particle localized at the other end of the extra dimension, and the other end is called the TEV or the infrared plane. Okay. Oh, sorry. So these are just, remember that every particle from the four-dimensional point of view actually has a profile in the extra dimension. Okay, so let me just back up. So I start with a five-dimensional particle. Okay, so if you just forget the four dimensions, just focus on the extra dimension, then it's just like a particle in a one-dimensional box. Okay, so you solve wave equations, and what you get are a tower of modes. Okay, and each mode appears as a particle from the four-dimensional point of view. Okay, and so therefore each mode, which I'm calling a particle from the four-dimensional point of view, actually has a profile or a wave function in the extra dimension. Okay, so what I'm plotting is profile of
it's supposed to be a wave function.
Yeah, or a profile.
Since the having the label where you say x beam is the vertical.
I should have said that. So when I draw the profile, of course, then the vertical axis is just the size of the wave function.
Okay.
But I'm just saying, you know, if you want, you can think of the usual four dimensions also along the vertical axis. But I mean. So it's clear, when I draw the profile, what I mean is that the vertical axis is the size of the wave function. But just to visualize, I was saying that the extra dimension is here, and the four dimensions are there. If you wish, you can imagine that the four dimensions are going into the plane of this screen.
Is it possible to see what you're doing in the following way? If there are four dimensions of space, okay, but actually the momentum space has five dimensions, so that
actually, not quite. So, I'm just, yeah, so.
In a sense, like the fifth dimension is not playing a role as a real dimension.
No, it is a real dimension. Actually, it is a real extra spatial dimension. It's just that it's compact, okay? And it's small in size. And because of that, from the four-dimensional point of view, it makes sense to decompose a five-dimensional field into a tower of modes. Okay? And what's going to happen, of course, is that the lightest modes are identified with the standard model of particles, and then there are heavier modes, the Kaluza-Klein modes, and the heavier modes have a mass of something like TeV. Okay? So we haven't seen those heavier modes yet. Okay? And so that's why, so this sort of KK decomposition is useful, because the idea is you have a tower of modes, and we have only seen the lightest modes. and the heavier moons have not yet been seen, because they are heavier than the energy of the current planetary system. And of course, the whole Tower of Moons builds up a real extra dimension, which of course is compact. So it is a real dimension in every sense. It's just that I can describe it from the four-dimensional point of view as a Tower of Moons.
Sure, but that the ADS, ADS CFT point of view, to what extent is that a conjecture here? To what extent is the duality between the classical primals in the five-dimensional picture and the strong coupled quantum excitations of the four-dimensional picture? Right. What extent is this a conjecture that you're then using?
So actually, there's a lot of evidence for this conjecture in string theory in the case when we have a lot of supersymmetry.
Right.
Okay. So the original examples involve supersymmetry.
Sure.
Now here I'm not having supersymmetry.
Right.
So really there is no evidence. But actually, but still the conjecture is that even without supersymmetry, the duality actually holds between so non-supersymmetric ADS5. And there are a lot of checks of this duality.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, there are a lot of checks at the qualitative level, and even at the semi-quantitative level, there are checks. Okay. And so I can tell you actually later about that. Okay. So you can do some checks even at the semi-quantitative level, even without supersymmetry. Okay. So it's still a conjecture, and maybe for this talk, I'm going to use this four-dimensional picture. Because it's much more intuitive, so as you'll see. So all calculations, of course, are done in the five-dimensional picture. Okay, so using sort of these two rules, you can sort of quickly translate the four-dimensional picture of compositing into the five-dimensional picture. And this is what you get. So remember I told you that the graviton was elementary in the four-dimensional picture. So using my first rule, this graviton is actually localized near the Planck point. And similarly, the Higgs boson is a composite in the four-dimensional picture. So using my second rule, it's localized near the TED. Okay? And so here's how the hierarchy problem is solved in this five-dimensional language. Okay? So what happens is that this extra dimension is a slice of ADS5, so it's a warp geometry. So what it gives is a so-called warp factor, because of which what happens is that the characteristic mass scale actually is a function of the position in the extra dimension. Okay? So for example, if you're near the Planck ring, then the characteristic mass scale is of order of the usual Planck scale. So since the graviton is localized here, that sort of accounts for the correct scale of four-dimensional gravity. Whereas if you go to the other end of the extra dimension, the cutoff is of order T, okay, again because of this warp factor. So that means that the cutoff for the quantum corrections to the Higgs mass is of order TV, and that's what is going to protect the Higgs mass from being dragged all the way up to the Planck. Okay? So just for simplicity, the way I obtain this RS1 model is sort of starting with the 4D picture and then using the two rules I mentioned. But of course, in reality, the profiles for the graviton and for all the particles, they are actually obtained by, like I said, solving wave equations in five-dimensional curved space-time. Okay? So solving these equations, you can show that the profile for the graviton is automatically localized near the Planck ring, and similarly, the Higgs boson has a profile which is automatically near the TED ring. Okay? And this follows from solving wave equations. And again, just for simplicity, when I sketch these profiles, I'm just going to give sort of a rough picture or a rough sketch, okay, for these profiles. But actually, there is a rich structure of these profiles. Okay, it turned out that these profiles are actually Bessel functions. And in fact, the structure depends on the spin of the five-dimensional particle. Okay?
Why should gravity see this extra dimension as any different from the others?
So you mean you're asking why only this extra dimension is curved? Is that the question? I mean, so it's the idea that only this extra dimension is sort of warped or curved. The usual four dimensions are flat, and the extra dimension is compact and it's actually curved.
Okay, why?
Sorry.
Why?
Okay, so at this level, yeah, that reduces the usual problem of why the usual four dimensions are flat. So I'm not answering that question. So somehow the compactification has.
There is an answer to that question. It's ground state of the Einstein equations with asymptotic flatten?
So actually, so you can obtain that ground state where the four dimensions are flat and only the extra dimension is curved by having sort of some relation between the bulk cosmological constant and the vacuum energy localized on the brain. Okay? So certainly this is a solution of Einstein's equation for a certain relation between the five-dimensional vacuum energy and the brain localized vacuum energy. Okay? But so I'm assuming that that relation is satisfied so that the solution to Einstein's equation is four-dimensional flat space and only the extra dimension being curved. Okay? So certainly, I mean, this is the solution of Einstein's equation for certain choice of vacuum energies on the brain and the vacuum energy in the pulse. Okay? But effectively, that's the same as the question of why the four-dimensional space is flat. Okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm not answering the question of why the observed cosmological constant is zero, small. All right, so basically this is the RS1 model, and so in this model, actually it was assumed that the entire standard model, including the fermions and the gauge fields, are localized on this brain. Okay, so it was called a brain world model. So next, I'm actually going to depart from this idea of brain world. Okay, so I'm going to put the standard model in the bulk. And of course, the Higgs boson remains on the TEV brain because we want to solve the hierarchy problem. And I'm going to show you that this setup with the standard model in the bulk actually solves the flavor puzzle of the standard model without generating a flavor problem. Okay, and I'll be explicit about what I mean by that. Okay? So again, because of the duality, actually I want to start with the four-dimensional picture. So again, the idea is there's some strong dynamics, the Higgs is a composite. Now imagine that the standard model fermions and gauge bosons are actually elementary particles, but they are not part of the strong dynamics. Okay? However, these standard model particles are nevertheless coupled to the strong dynamics. So for example, here is a standard model gauge field, which is coupled to some conserved current of the strong dynamics. Similarly, here are standard model fermions coupled to some fermionic operator of the strong dynamics. Okay, and the strong dynamics is a CFT, approximate CFT. Okay? Now what happens is, because of this coupling of external fermions to fermionic operators, clearly there is mixing between this fermion psi and composite fermions coming from this operator. Okay, very similar to the photon row mixing in real QCD. Okay, so what this means is that the physical or the standard model fermion is really a mixture of this external fermion and composite fermion. Okay? And the amount of mixing obviously depends on the scaling dimension of the operator. Okay? Now, since the Higgs boson is a composite of this strong dynamic, it's clear that the Yukawa coupling of the standard model fermion to the Higgs must proceed via the composite component of this standard model fermion. Okay? So that means fermion masses are proportional to this mixing or to this coupling lambda. Okay? So then the choice is sort of clear that for the first and second generation, for the light generation, this operator is actually irrelevant, which means that the amount of mixing or this coupling lambda is small. So that means that the physical electron, for example, is mostly this external or fundamental electron. Okay? And exactly the opposite for the top quark, because the top quark has a large coupling to the Higgs. So it must be that the top quark is mostly made of these composite fermions. Okay? Because only then can it have a large coupling to the Higgs, which is also a composite. Okay? So this is sort of solving a flavor puzzle, and I'll come back to this in the five-dimensional language. Now let's look at flavor convergence, or FCNCs. And let's look at it in the same four-dimensional picture, and you'll see that it's very intuitive in this four-dimensional language. And this is really one of the crucial slides of this part of my talk. Okay? So clearly the FCNCs are coming because of exchange of massive composites, if you wish, rho mnons. Okay? Because those are the new particles or the new physics. So clearly the coupling of these rho mnons to the standard model fermions must proceed via the composite component of the standard model fermion. Okay, which means the coupling of the fermions to the rho mesons must be proportional to the same mix. Okay, so here's the standard model fermion mixing with the strong dynamics and thereby coupling to the rho meson. So you exchange the rho meson, you get four fermion operators, or FCNCs. So clearly the FCNCs are proportional to this mixing or this coupling lambda. Okay? But clearly the fermion mass is also proportional to the same mixing. So the fermion mass is obtained from the same diagram where I replace the rho meson by another composite, namely the Higgs boson. Okay? So what you see is that FCNCs are proportional to the fermion masses. So K-on mixing is small because the strain and the down quarks are large. So this is very reminiscent of what is called the Glashow-Villiopoulos-Miani or the JIM mechanism in the standard model, where the meson mixing happens at the loop level, and it's also proportional to the masses of the fermions or the quarks in the loop. Okay? So what you see is that this setup avoids large FCNCs or does not have a flavor problem because of a built-in JIM mechanism, okay? Unlike a generic supersymmetric model. Okay, so let's look at the same thing translated into the five-dimensional picture. And you expect that the fermions in the five-dimensional picture actually propagate in the extra dimension. Okay? Again, here's the electron, which is mostly elementary or fundamental in the four-dimensional picture. So in the five-dimensional picture, its profile is localized near the Planck plane. Similarly, the top quark is composite in the four-dimensional picture. So in the five-dimensional picture, it's localized near the TV. Okay? And in this five-dimensional picture, this localization of the fermion occurs because of a five-dimensional mass parameter, which is usually denoted by a dimensionless number called the C parameter. Okay? So what happens is that this C parameter of the 5D mass basically acts like a domain wall. That's why it localizes the zero mode of the five-dimensional fermions, namely the standard model fermion. Okay? And in particular, the electron is localized near the Planck plane because its C parameter is bigger than half, whereas the top quark has a C parameter less than half, and that's why it's localized near the TV. Okay? So the point is that since the electron is localized here, its overlap with the Higgs, which is localized at the other end, is going to be small. Okay? So that accounts for the small Yukawa coupling of the electron. Similarly, the top quark is going to have a large coupling to the Higgs boson. Okay? So the crucial thing is here I'm assuming that the Yukawa coupling at the five-dimensional level is really the same for both the electron and the top quark. Okay? And the hierarchies in the four-dimensional Yukawas are instead obtained by these widely different profiles. Okay? And again, the crucial thing is that these widely different profiles can be easily obtained by just small variations in the five-dimensional mass, okay, or the C parameter. Okay? So it is in this sense that I'm solving the flavor puzzle of the standard model. Namely, the hierarchies in the four-dimensional Yukawas can be accounted for or explained without any hierarchies at the five-dimensional or the fundamental level. So there are, again, no hierarchies in the five-dimensional Yukawa and hardly any hierarchies in the five-dimensional mass or the C parameter. Okay? All right? So,
could you say a little more explicitly, what is the C parameter?
Yeah, so it's actually the five-dimensional mass for the fermion measured in units of the curvature scale. That's what it is. Okay? And I can show you later that actually it's not that difficult. So if you plot the 5D mass, you can show that it looks like a, its profile looks like a domain wall. Then you're not surprised that you get localization of zero.
Do you have to take it close to half to get the hierarchy to work?
Yeah, so roughly it turns out that, so I'll get into this a little bit detail, that most of the fermions have C parameter close to half, okay? So they're around half. But as I'll show you later, that the right-handed top has a slightly different C parameter. It's something like zero or negative. Okay? So all the Cs are sort of close to half. They're certainly order one, okay? Which means that the 5D mass is of order the curvature scale. Okay?
Not really.
Because so remember, there is also the five-dimensional Yukawa, which is a free parameter. Okay, so it's not that I need to tune the C very precisely. Okay, there is a range. Basically, what's going to happen is there's a range of C parameters, maybe a small range, and a range of the five dimensional you cover, with which you can reproduce the observed photonic mass. So, of course, to explain the electron mass, I need to choose some C parameter and some five dimensional you cover. Otherwise, of course, I cannot explain the observed power. But there is some freedom in choosing, basically you choose a combination of the C parameter and the 5 EU power. And there is a range of combinations which work. Okay.
You maybe already said this, but I'm more unclear about whether these standard model fermions are coming from entirely from separate fundamental fields in the five-dimensional picture, or are they...
So they are separate fields. No, so there is a separate five-dimensional fermion field. There's a separate five-dimensional gravitational field. And in fact, so my next slide is that there is a separate five-dimensional gauge.
I think he's asking,
okay, so, and then for each different fermion, there is a different five-dimensional field. So the electron is a zero mode of one five-dimensional fermion. The top quark is a zero mode of a different five-dimensional.
So if the top is a low C mode of field, is there also a high C mode of that same field?
No, so every five dimensional fermion has a particular C parameter or a five dimensional mode. Okay? And then when I decompose that for every five dimensional fermion, there is a five dimensional mass, which is this C parameter. Okay? And then I decompose this 5D field, and I get only one zero mode. And the profile of that zero mode is controlled by the C parameter for that five-dimensional field.
Okay, so these are all zero modes.
Yeah. So actually, for fermions, I'm not going to talk about Kaluza-Klein modes at all at this time. Okay? But of course, there are heavier modes for every fermion, but which are not relevant for this talk today. Okay? So as I was saying, the gauge fields are also in the bulk, and effectively, the gauge fields are like a fermion which seems to have. What that means is that the zero mode of the gauge field actually has a flat profile. Okay, this is the standard model gauge boson. And there are also Kaluza-Klein modes for the gauge field. Okay? And remember I told you that the KK modes are dual to hadrons or composites in the four-dimensional picture. So using my second rule, it must be that these KK modes are actually localized here in the TEV field. Okay, so that's what happens. So clearly the coupling of the KK mode to the electron is going to be small. Similarly, the coupling of the top quark to the gauge KK mode is going to be large, because both the top and the gauge KK mode are localized near the TEV. Okay? Again, I should say that all these profiles are obtained by solving five-dimensional wave equations. Okay? So, but just for simplicity, I was just using the rules. But
could you please say again why KK modes are localized near the infrared frame?
Well, so the real answer is it follows from the solving the five-dimensional wave equation.
For each field, you
would say? For all the fields. So all the profiles ultimately are obtained by solving 5D wave equation. And the reason you get localization is because the geometry is warped or curved. So it's not a flat, or it's not a regular ball. Okay? And then the way I motivated things was that all the modes which are localized near the TEV plane are composites in the four-dimensional picture. Okay? So this agrees with the fact that I was interpreting the KK modes as components. Okay.
But I guess what you are also saying is that if I just look for Kaluza, solve Young-Gell's equations in the bulk, there will be a zero mode, there will be Kaluza Klein mode, and the wave function of the Kaluza Klein mode will happen to be localized.
Exactly.
Computation.
Yeah. So that's I was trying to give an intuitive picture based on this duality that the KK modes are dual to hadrons. And that's why using my rule, they should be localized here in the TEV field. Okay? So again, everything localized here should be interpreted as hadrons or composites in the 4D picture. Okay? So, but that, yeah.
There's a quick technical question. So what you mean by grains are the space-time is the four-dimensional space-time plus the minimum bulk?
Yes.
So what boundary conditions is this all separate?
You mean for every field, what are the boundary conditions?
Yeah.
So for most, for the fields which have zero modes, they have Neumann boundary conditions on both the fields. Okay, so only then do you get actual massless zero mode. Okay. All right, so so what I want to show you next very quickly is that if you look at the top and the bottom in detail, then it turns out that it's the right-handed top fork, not the left-handed top fork, which is composite, and that's going to play a very crucial role in the rest of my talk. Okay, so I'll try to speed up a little bit. So for that, I need to tell you what is the Kaluza-Klein mass scale. And so as in any extension of the standard model, there are going to be constraints on the Kaluza-Klein mass scale coming from the precision test done on the gauge boson. Okay. So one of these observables, called the T parameter, strongly suggests that the new physics, in this case the strong dynamics in the four-dimensional picture, it suggests that this strong dynamics must have a global symmetry, which is actually larger than the symmetry SU2 left of the electroweak interface. That is, the global symmetry must include an extra SU2 right symmetry. Okay, and this is called the custodial isospin symmetry. Okay, the standard model weak sector actually has such a custodial isospin symmetry. Okay, and as we showed in this paper with Antonio Delgado, Michael May, and Ramon Sundaram, it's a bit subtle that this requirement of a global custodial isospin actually translates into extending the five-dimensional gauge symmetry. Okay? So the gauge symmetry has to include this extra SU2 right factor. And once you have this extra symmetry, then KK scale can be as small as 3 or 4 TeV. And you can be consistent with the electroweak precision data, the T parameter, and also the S parameter. Okay? Just to show you that without this extra SU2 right symmetry, the composite scale has to be something like 10 TeV. Okay? So the basic idea here is that, as it should be clear, that the standard model has some very nice protective mechanisms, okay, which seem to be in very good agreement with the data. Okay? So the idea is that if the new physics preserves those same mechanisms or features, then you maintain the good agreement of the standard model with the data. So here you see an example of custodial isospin. So again, the Higgs sector in the standard model has custodial isospin. Earlier you saw an example with the Jim mechanism. Okay? So that's the nice thing about this framework, that you can actually preserve the nice features of the standard model and thereby preserve the agreement of the standard model with the data.
What are the four dimensions there? Are those fine modes vector left?
Yes.
So that's why they didn't drop out of S?
Basically, yeah. So it's a bit complicated because there is actually mixing between 0 and KK modes, and so it does contribute to the S parameter. And but with this 3-4 TeV KK scale, it's fine. Okay, okay, so once you know that the KK scale is few TeV, let's look at then the top and bottom quarks. I told you that the top quark is heavy, so it must be localized near the TeV brain in the 5D picture, or it must be composite in the 4-dimensional picture. However, there is a constraint from Z to BV bar, which combined with the KK mass of 3 or 4 TeV actually tells us that the profile of the bottom left, and therefore the top left, cannot be very close to the TeV brain. Okay, so here's the profile for the top and bottom left. It must be close to a flat profile, namely the C parameter must be close to half. Okay, so that means it must be the right-handed top, which is localized very close to the TeV brain. Okay? So that means, so you cannot read it, but that means that the C parameter for the top quark is actually zero or negative. Okay, remember, C being less than half means localization near the TeV brain, and the top right must have a C which is zero or even negative, so that means it's localized very, very close to the TeV. Or in the 4D picture, it's the right in the top, which is actually composite. Okay, so what you see here also is that even though the bottom left has a close to flat profile, nevertheless, its coupling to this gauge KK mode is kind of large. Okay? Namely, again, the coupling of the bottom left to the gauge KK mode is proportional actually to the top left, instead of being proportional to the bottom. Okay? Again, because the bottom quark itself is very light. Okay, so if I just looked at the bottom mass, then I would localize the bottom left actually close to the Planck. But it's the heavy top mass which is forcing the bottom left to be just a little bit near the TeV brain, okay, and therefore giving a large coupling to the gauge KK mode. Of course, the strain and the down are localized here, therefore their coupling to the gauge KK mode is very small. So what this means is that couplings of the bottom left actually violate the gel mechanism, again, because of the top core being heavy. So very similar to what happens in the standard model. And therefore, you get FCNCs involving the bottom left. For example, a KK gluon being exchanged gives contributions like this. We can show, actually, that the coupling of the bottom left to the gauge KK mode is of order of the standard model strength. And that, combined with this KK mass of 3 or 4 TeV, actually gives rise to very striking signals at the B factor. Okay? So I'm really running out of time, so I'm going to skip all these details. So there's a rich class of signals. So let me just mention that, and I can tell people in detail later on. Okay? So let me get going. So again, here's the summary of the model. Okay. Again, there's some, you cannot read this. So there's, again, some strong dynamics, which is an approximate conformal field theory. The Higgs and the top right are composites. And here are the electron or the light fermion. They are elementary, and they are weakly coupled to the strong energy, okay, which corresponds to them being localized near the Planck ring. The gauge bosons at the top bottom left have sort of a marginal or a moderate coupling to the strong energy, which just corresponds to the fact that they have a close to a flat profile in the five-dimensional picture. Okay? So in the remaining part, remaining talk, I'm going to actually grand unify this particular model. Okay, and in particular, what you'll see is that the right-handed top being composite, So the right-handed top being composite will actually lead to gauge coupling unification, which is comparable to supersymmetry in this grand unified model, and also combining with proton stability in the same grand unified model, it actually leads to a very good dark matter candidate. Okay, so again, I'm going to look at unification in this warp extra dimension. And so the first concern might be proton decay, especially because the new physics is really at the TeV scale. Okay, so the solution to this problem is what the idea of split fermion multiplets. So let me explain that. Okay, so here's the strong dynamics. Okay, and I should say that for this unification and the dark matter part, I'm mostly going to use the four-dimensional picture, because that's much more intuitive. Okay, so again, here's the strong dynamics. Suppose it has a SU5 global symmetry. Okay, so SU5 is a grand unified group. But that only the standard model subgroup of this SU5 symmetry is actually gauge. So there are no elementary X or Y gauge bosons. So these are the gauge bosons which are part of SU5, but not the standard model. Okay? So what this means is really there is no gauged grand unified symmetry. Okay? So which means the standard model quarks and leptons really don't have to be gut partners of each other. Okay, so here's sort of the idea. So here's the elementary lepton. It couples to some operator of the strong dynamics, okay, of the CFT. Here's an elementary quark coupled to another operator of the strong dynamics. But these two operators are not partners of each other, simply because there is really no gauge symmetry. Okay? So I told you there are no elementary X or Y, but there are composite X and Y with a mass of TeV. So these are just the KK modes of the X and Y gauge field. Okay? However, these composite X and Y gauge bosons cannot couple these two operators. Again, because they are not partners of each other. And therefore, these composite X and Y cannot couple the standard model quark to the standard model lepton. Okay, so we avoid proton decay from these TeV mass scale X and Y bosons. Okay? So even though the quarks and leptons are not gut partners of each other, one still retains the explanation of the quantization of their charges. Okay, and the reason is that these operators, okay, even though they are not gut partners of each other, they must be part of complete SU5 representations, like a 5 bar or a 10. Okay, because the strong dynamics has an SU5 global series. So that means, in turn, these elementary quarks and leptons must have quantum numbers which fit inside a complete SU5 representation. Okay, and that explains why their hypercharges are quantized, okay, even though the quarks and leptons are not really unified in the usual sense.
That's the the light level is the standard model only in noise and particles, right?
Sorry?
Once you integrate out the 59 states, then all you have is the standard model.
Yeah, exactly.
But in that sense, wouldn't the mixed gravitational gauge anomalies have already told you why the charge is
in the yes, so you can argue based on, sure, the anomaly is why we have the charge is quantized. And that's another way to do it. But here I was trying to say that even the other explanation that the hyperchargers fit inside SU5, even that is retained. Okay, but you're right, that is the other argument based on anomalies. Okay? So of course the anomalies doesn't sort of uniquely specify the hyperchargers. There could be other assignments of hyperchargers which can be anomaly too. So this, you know, embedding the hypercharges inside SU5 of course gives you more restrictions. But you're right, anomalies can also be.
I don't want to distract you too much, so we can talk maybe later, but I don't quite understand what do you mean, you gauge a part of SU5,
mm-hmm.
But SU5 is a global symmetry, so how can you do that? You break SU5 if you gauge only part.
Yeah, so you're right, so when you gauge only standard model, you're sort of breaking SU5,
so
but the idea is that the gauging is kind of a weak perturbation, okay? So in that sense, the strong dynamics is going to have an approximate global SU5. You're right, absolutely, that once you gauge only standard model, you're introducing an explicit breaking. But the point is that this coupling here of the gauge bosons to the strong dynamics is sort of weak or marginal. And therefore, this breaking is sort of small. But
your global symmetry became local in the dual state.
Exactly, yes. The global SU5.
Is that also a feature?
Yes, so the global SU5 will translate into exactly a gauge SU5 in the five-dimensional model. Okay.
So then the special feature of the standard model just that there's no masses. The only zero ones are in the standard model.
Yeah, exactly. So the fact that only standard model is gauge means that on the Planck brain, I'm going to break SU5 to standard model, resulting in zero modes only for standard model, but not for X and Y. That's exactly it. So I think what's clear is that this setup can easily maintain the standard model level of unification. Okay, the idea is that the strong dynamics has SU5 global symmetry, so it contributes universally to the running of the standard model gauge coupling. Similarly, the standard model fermions, at least naively, give a universal contribution because they also come in complete SU5 model frames. Okay, so that's the only differential running comes from the standard model gauge boson in this picture. And that means that the level of unification is at least at the level of standard model, which is something like 10%. Okay. Sorry, you cannot see this. Okay. However, you know that this cannot be the complete story, because I told you that the Higgs is a composite. Also, the top right is a composite. Okay. So it's clear that this picture of the unification will have to be modified. And in fact, it sort of leads to a sort of a new framework for unification. So let me go through that a little bit in more detail.
Before we get into this, just to go back for a second, in the dual picture, it's an SU5 gauge series, and once it includes the Planck level, then you have the whole SU5.
Yes, exactly.
But you said that you had split multiples at the masses level.
Mm-hmm.
What about for variant number violations? Is the variant actually conserved?
So what I argued was that the X and Y modes don't lead to proton decay, okay, because the X and Y modes cannot couple standard model quarks to standard model electrons. Okay? So in that sense, the interactions of X and Y do preserve the usual baryon number. I mean, simply because there is no coupling of a quark and electron, standard model quark and standard model electron, to an X and Y gauge quark.
So there's an explicit global symmetry there, a baryon number, or is it?
So at this level, it's actually accidental because of this split multiplier. But I'll come back to actually baryon number symmetry later on. Okay? So at this level, as soon as I have a split multiplier, baryon number appears as a sort of an accidental symmetry.
That's
okay?
The
masses. Let's see. So you're worried about KK modes?
Right, because that's the TV scale, so there are still changes there.
No, not so. You're worried about loop effects or something, or what?
I'm worried that you don't have. Why don't you have, say, X and Y bosons that are on the TV scale, Planck scale, but they have tree couplings between.
So remember, the quark and electron are coming from two different 5D multipliers, right? So the x and y. So clearly you cannot couple two standard model zeros.
But in the end of the day, is it going to be the program is exactly stable, or is some dimension that is not greater than?
Actually, yeah, let me come back to that very quickly. So I'll show you that actually eventually you have to impose a Baryon number symmetry on your whole setup, because there are other sources of proton. Okay, so I'll come back to that. Okay, so yeah, again, so the so the idea, the first modification, the first idea in this sort of new framework, so is that the right-handed top and the Higgs are composites, okay, of the strong dynamics. So that means as I go above the TEV scale, I have to replace the running due to the top right-handed Higgs by the running due to the constituent or the CFT. Okay? But the CFT or the strong dynamics has a global SU5 symmetry. So that means it does not contribute to differential running. Okay? So that means as far as differential running is concerned, what I need to do is take the running in the standard model but subtract the contribution of the top right at the Higgs. Okay? This is again as far as differential running is concerned. And if you do this, you can actually show that this improves unification of gauge couplings relative to the standard model. Okay? So this is really a new sort of paradigm for unification, because usually one is used to adding particles to the standard model running, so as in supersymmetry, and that improves unification. Here, effectively, you are subtracting contribution of certain standard model particles, and that is actually improving unification. Okay? But you know that this cannot be the complete story. Okay, so this is not the only effect. Because the reason is we have to look at the gut partners of the right-handed top. Okay, here's how it works. Again, here is the strong dynamics, top right is a composite. But because of the global SU5 symmetry, approximate global SU5 symmetry of the strong dynamics, there has to be a whole 10 multiplied of SU5, which is actually composed, containing the right-handed top. Okay? So there is a quark doublet, there is also a lepton. But clearly, these guys, I don't want them to be standard model particles, okay? Because otherwise I will get proton decay. Okay? Because X and Y, TEV scale X and Y modes will couple all these particles. Okay, so these are unwanted massless composites. That's why I'm denoting them by these primes. Okay? So the way I get rid of them is to add elementary particles in the conjugate representation, and they couple to the strong dynamics, and they marry these composites, okay, and make them heavy. Okay? So it's these guys which I'm calling sort of a part of an anti-generation, because their quantum numbers are conjugate to that of a usual generation. So here's the anti-generation, but it's an incomplete anti-generation, obviously.
Is it only the top quark that has this problem?
Yeah, only top right has to be composite, because basically it's heavy and so on. Okay. So to first of all the other fermions are are elementary, okay? And only the top right is composite.
But presumably your anti-generation is in among the SU5 as well.
Actually, no, because remember, the idea is that only the strong sector has SU5 global symmetry. The elementary particles are not in SU5 multiple. Already the gauge bosons were in incomplete SU5 multiple. Okay? So again, the idea is there are two sectors of the theory, the strong sector, which has at least approximate SU5 global symmetry. And then there is the elementary sector, which does not have SU5. Okay? Again, because I'm not gauging the SU5 symmetry. Okay, what this means in the 5D picture is simply that the bulk and the TEV brain have exact SU5 gauge symmetry, but on the Planck brain, I'm breaking the SU5 gauge symmetry.
So
anything on the Planck brain corresponds to particles which are elementary, as I said, in the four-dimensional picture.
But when you go to the bulk, it has SU5 first.
Yeah, sure. So that's why there are composites are all in complete SU5 multiple, including the heavy composite. So again, the elementary particles correspond to, remember, particles localized on the Planck brain, and Planck brain does not respect the gauge SU5 symmetry. Okay, that's why these guys don't have even a global SU5. Okay, so there is this anti-generation. So it's clear that you have to look at running from the anti-generation as well. Let me do the simplest case where the coupling of the anti-generation to the strong dynamics is sort of weak, which means that the C parameter for the top right is actually close to minus half or even smaller. So in that case, it's clear that you have to just simply add the running due to the anti-generation. So this elementary quark doublet and the lepton. Anyway, so let me read this. So remember, earlier the running was standard model minus links minus top right. Now I have to add the contribution of this anti-generation. Okay? Yeah, I really apologize for this. But remember that the anti-generation and the right-handed top form a complete SU5 multiplet. Okay? So that means adding the running due to these guys is equivalent, as far as differential running is concerned, to subtracting another top right in the running. Okay? So that's why the differential running looks like this. So you have to subtract two top rights, essentially. So I already told you, subtracting one top right improves gentrification. So subtracting a second top right actually improves it even further. Okay? So here's the running at the leading order, or the one loop level. Okay, again, so again, this is standard model minus links minus two top right. Okay, so here are the three couplings, and I'm just plotting the differential running of the cage coupling. So here's alpha 1 minus alpha 2, here's alpha 1 minus alpha 3. So you see that the three lines meet at an energy of something like 10 to the 15 GeV. Okay, and they meet kind of precisely. Okay. So this meeting actually motivates looking at a next to leading order analysis or two loop runs. Okay. And let me just tell you that very, very briefly.
How close is that meeting compared to some
standard? Yeah, so I'm actually going to come to that. So I can I have like 10 more minutes? Okay. So I don't have time, so let me just briefly mention this thing about two-loop running. So here's the standard model two-loop running. And the crucial thing is that this loop correction actually improves unification. Okay? So I didn't have time to set up the notation, but the thing is that the two-loop correction, its size and its sign are roughly same as in the standard model. Okay? And you can sort of see here that this meeting here is not quite perfect, okay, at one loop level. But what happens is that the sign and the size of the two-loop correction is such that it precisely improves that discrepancy at one loop. Okay? And so let me just finish this. Okay, so let me just tell you the sort of the final result. Okay, so at the end of doing this two-loop running and looking at what are the sources of errors and so on, the end result is 2% unification. So let me be a bit more precise. So unfortunately, I didn't have time to tell you what my notation is for the percentages, but it doesn't matter because you can just compare different models, and that should be good enough. Okay, so here are the numbers for the standard model and the MSSN. There's a central value. Okay, so that's the amount of sort of threshold corrections required to fix up unification. Okay, so that's the amount by which you miss in the unification. And the second number, which is sort of the error, is the amount of threshold correction. Okay, so the nice thing in the MSSN is that the amount of threshold corrections are a few percent in some units. And that few percent is enough to account for the 2% discrepancy, okay, in the two-loop running. Okay? Whereas in the standard model, the threshold corrections or the error are about a few percent, but you miss by 10%. Okay, so the error is not enough to account for the discrepancy in the unification. Okay, so here's what you get in this setup. Again, I'm assuming that the anti-generation has a weak coupling to the strong dynamics, which means the C for the top right is close to minus half. So the number you get is something like this. Okay. So let me just tell you what. So the central value is really good. So I've shown actually zero here. The reason is it's actually smaller than a percent. But of course, the crucial thing is not just the central value, but the size of the error. Okay? Because it's no good having a central value which is zero when the error is large. And the error is actually of order a few percent. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, great, thank you very much. Okay. So again, the central value is really good, but what is more crucial is the error. And the error is actually 2%. And the reason for that is that the error comes from diagrams like this. So there are contributions of the strong dynamics, which are sort of dressed by standard model gauge. Okay? And you can quickly estimate that the size of this unknown effect is basically comparable to the standard model 2 loop run. Okay? And the standard model 2 loop running turned out to be of order a few percent in these loops. Okay? So again, this is at the end of doing 2 loop running in this warped extra dimension, and the error comes from diagrams like this. So what you see is that unification is really as precise as what you get in supersymmetric. And it's really striking, and it's really completely different than supersymmetry because it's happening because the top right is composite, which in turn is because the top is heavy and there was a constraint from Z to BB bar. Okay? Okay, so again, I can tell you more details later on. So let me just quickly go in 5 minutes to the last part of my talk, which is to show you that requiring proton stability in this setup with the Grandin criteria leads to a dark matter candidate, a bit similar to what happens in supersymmetry. Okay, the reason is there are actually exotic particles as follows. Again, here's the strong dynamics. Now it has a SO10 global symmetry because I need to include a custodial isostability. Here's the top right, which is composite. Now there's a whole 16 of SO10, which is composite. Again, because the strong dynamics has global SO10 symmetry. So among other particles in the 16, there are these right-handed leptons, neutrino and an electron. As usual, I get rid of these unwanted particles by adding anti-generation or elementary particles in conjugate representation, which couple to the strong dynamics and marry these unwanted components. Okay? So I told you that there was no proton decay from X and Y modes. Okay? However, there is still proton decay possible from basically string modes or cutoff states, which in fact have a mass of something like 10 TeV. Okay? These just correspond to higher dimensional operators localized on the TeV frame. Okay? That's why the scale suppressing these higher dimensional operators is low, okay, because they are on the TeV frame. Okay, so one way to forbid this is actually just to impose a global baryon number symmetry on the whole model. So the strong dynamics has a global baryon number symmetry. This whole composite has a baryon number of 1/3 corresponding to the right-handed top quark. Similarly, these elementary anti-generations have an opposite baryon number of -1/3. Okay? So again, I need this global baryon number symmetry to avoid proton string state. And the reason I can impose this baryon number symmetry, in spite of having this SO10, is that really I have split multiplets. The quarks and leptons are not partners of each other. And that's why I can actually impose a global baryon number symmetry. So the five-dimensional language, the idea would be that the entire multiplet, five-dimensional multiplet, which gives a zero-mode lepton, will actually have a zero baryon number, or an entire five-dimensional fermion which gives a quark as a zero mode, that whole thing will have baryon number of 1/3, plus or minus 1/3. And I can do that because really I don't have a gauge grand unified symmetry. Okay? Okay, so what you see here is that there are lepton-like states, so here, so these guys, which have no color, but they have a baryon number of 1/3. Okay? So there are many other such states, massive states, which have what I call wrong combination of color and baryon number. Okay? In fact, these guys are charged under a Z3 symmetry. Okay? So if you wish, the standard model has the right combination of baryon number and color, namely in the standard model, only colored particles have baryon number. So the standard model particles are not charged under this Z3 symmetry. So that means that the lightest Z3 charged particle, or the LZP, is actually stable. Then the issue is, what is the lightest Z3 charged particle? And I told you that the coupling of the anti-generation here can be sort of moderate or marginal, which means these gut partners, massive gut partners on the right hand top, can actually be light, namely their mass can be about few hundred GeV, even though the Kaluga line mass scale is a forward refugee. Okay? So that means it's possible that this right-handed neutrino partner of the top quark is actually the light density three charged particle, and therefore it's stable. And remember, all this is happening because the top quark is heavy. Okay? So I'm really running out of time, so I wanted to show you that this exotic right-handed neutrino, or this LZP, actually is a weakly interacting massive particle of a wimp, and so it's a very good dark matter candidate. So it has the correct relative density. So let me just flash this slide. Actually, not really. So, so actually, we haven't done a detailed analysis, but it's plausible that when you start with, all the particles are degenerate because of the SO10 symmetry. But then when you do loop correction, it's plausible that the right-handed neutrino is actually the lightest particle because it doesn't, it's a standard mono singlet. Okay, basically all the other particles, all the other partners on the top right, they get a little bit heavier because of loop corrections from standard mono degeneration. Okay? But we haven't studied that in detail. So sort of at the leading level, they're all degenerate, but loop corrections can do can basically cause split. Okay? And there are actually other possibilities to actually split the masses. So one idea is you sort of weakly break the SO10 symmetry of the strong dynamic. Okay? So you can imagine that the SO10 is not an exact symmetry. It's broken by a small amount. And then these guys get split in mass. Okay? So it's a little bit like supersymmetry where you know, it's possible that squark or slepton could be the lightest supertron. Okay? So let me just flash this very quickly. So the prospects for direct detection are very good. So here are the cross sections for scattering of nuclei, of protons and nuclei, protons and neutrons from nuclei detectors. So I'm plotting this as a function of one of the parameters of the model. And each band is for a given mass of the KK mode. So these are the heavier KK modes. So 3 dB, 4 dB, and so on. Remember that the dark matter itself is of order a few hundred dB. And again, for each KK mass, you get a band because you vary the other parameters of the model. Okay? So the crucial thing is that here's the current CDMS limit. So you see that it's already probing a KK mass scale of something like 3 or 4 dB. Okay? So we have to remember live below this red line. Okay? And really, if you look in the future limits are somewhere here. So that even if the KK mass scale is something like 10 dB, so it's a really extreme case where the model starts to become unnatural, even that case will be actually probed by the future experiment.
What time scale?
Actually, good question. So I wasn't able to find out what is the time scale for this. So this is an experiment which is going on. So this is the present limit from this experiment. Here's the future limit. And this is really, I think Zeppelin is really a planned experiment. But the CDNS is going on right now, I think.
In the future, when they talk about putting in snow, that's,
you know, 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah, could be. So I was trying to dig into what is the timeline, but I couldn't find it. Okay, so let me just conclude. So I've explored the idea that strong dynamics plays a role in electroweak symmetry breaking. And this idea is very attractive, but it's very hard to do any calculation. Okay, so for this purpose, what I did was I used the warped XO dimension effectively as a tool to calculate in this four-dimensional theory. Okay, so one immediate question about strong dynamics being involved in electroweak symmetry breaking is whether it's alive. Okay. What is the viability? And there are two issues there. One is precision electroweak data. And I sort of didn't have time to tell you, but I can tell you later if you're interested, that with this 3-4 dB KK mass scale and composite Higgs model, we actually can satisfy the electroweak data at the expense of some 10% fine tuning. And the other issue for viability is actually flavor physics. And there I showed you that partial compositeness in the four-dimensional picture or profiles in the five-dimensional picture actually can explain the hierarchy of fermion masses and mixings without leading to any large flavor changing effects. Okay? And one idea which emerges is that the right-handed top is actually composite. And I didn't have time to show you this, but it turns out that this right-handed top being composite actually plays a role in breaking electroweak symmetry radiatively. Okay? And a little bit like what happens in supersymmetry. Okay? So then I also showed you that this right-handed top being composite leads to other nice features. One is gauge coupling unification at the few percent level. Combining with proton stability, you get very good dark matter candidate. Just to compare this to the flavor sector, generically does not look good. Unification and dark matter, of course, are very good. And the fine-tuning typically is, at best, 10%. Okay, so having seen that this setup of warp texture dimension or composite gains is not only viable, but it has very nice features. So the next question is, how do we test it? So I briefly told you about indirect signals at B factories. And the fact that the right-handed top is composite can also be tested at linear collider and a large hadron collider. And the dark matter can be directly detected with very good prospects. So let me finish. So here's my last slide. By sort of telling you that a direct signal for this model, and by that I mean actually producing these QTV KK modes, is kind of challenging. Okay? So of course this has to be done at the Large Hadron Collider. Okay, so let's look at an example of producing this KK gluon. So you can produce it by fusion of QQ bar, okay, light quarks coming from the proton. But the problem is that this coupling is a little bit suppressed compared to the usual QCD coupling. Because remember, these guys are sort of elementary, whereas this guy is composite. Okay? So that could be maybe a potential problem. Now, of course, the right-handed top has a very strong coupling to the KK gluon, because all these guys are composite. So this coupling is actually enhanced by a factor of something like 5 compared to the QCD coupling. But of course, it's hard to use this diagram to produce a KK gluon, because it's very hard to obtain the top quark from the proton. Okay? But clearly, once you produce this KK gluon, it's going to decay dominantly into the top quark, again, because of this strong coupling. Okay? So this signal is very unique, very distinct from supersymmetry or flat extra dimension. Okay? Now, there have been previous studies of collider signals in this model. There are also technical studies, and these are useful. Okay, but clearly they are not enough. Okay, and the reason is that it's only now that we have a complete picture of this framework, namely including fermions and so on. Okay? In particular, this signal here, to my knowledge, actually has not been studied before. Okay? So let me just finish by saying that there's a lot of work to be done by both experimentalists and theorists, so that we can be ready to observe this exciting new physics at the LHC in about 4 or 5 years. Okay? Thank you. Yeah, sorry for going over time.
No, it's very exciting to have somebody end with your